now 100 years old, and with his first attempt at fathering a son having failed to meet with God's exacting standards, the job of repopulating the earth seems more out of reach than ever for Abraham. First, though, Abraham has to make the agreement with God official. This involves an act of surgery that will be a physical sign to God that Abraham and his people are in a relationship with him. Every male in Abraham's family is to have his foreskin removed. The act is symbolic. If anyone breaks the covenant by disowning God, he will be cut off from him in the same way that the foreskin is separated from the body. Every boy over 8 days old is to be circumcised, as is the son of any household member or any slave who is brought into the home. Anyone not circumcised can consider himself cut off from God, Abraham is told. Incidentally, circumcision is the world's oldest planned surgical procedure. Originally, it was carried out using knives made from obsidian. According to the Genesis account, God then repeats his promise that Abraham and Sarai will have a son. He changes Sarai's name to Sarah, and in the same way that Abraham will be the father of nations, Sarah will be the mother. Abraham falls to the ground at the news and laughs. It just seems too fantastical. He's almost 100 years old, and his wife is 90, and he tells God that he wishes Ishmael were good enough for his blessing. God assures Abraham that Sarah will indeed be their son's mother. The child will be named Isaac, and God's promise to Abraham will live on through the boy and his descendants forever. That's not to say Ishmael has been written off. God reassures the old man that his teenage son will be the father of 12 rulers, and that he will eventually become a great nation in his own right. However, Isaac is the one who has been chosen to fulfill God's great plan for his people. God promises that by this time next year, Abraham and Sarah's child will have been born. Once God has left him, Abraham takes Ishmael and all the other men and boys in his household and circumcises them. He too goes under the knife, setting in motion a tradition that continues today among both Jews and Muslims. Soon after God changes Abraham and Sarai's names to Abraham and Sarah, three mysterious strangers approach their tent. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible, Episode 5, Fire from the Sky. A couple of reminders before we jump in. I'm not a theologian, nor am I a priest. I'm an advertising creative director who believes that the Bible is such a fantastic collection of books that it's worth spending many hours a week that might otherwise be dedicated to my wife and daughter, representing them to a public who might otherwise never read them. The Bible I refer to is the New International Version UK edition. Lastly, some people may find me and this podcast overly flippant and insulting to their beliefs. That is not my intention. My hope remains that you listen with an open mind. The Bible isn't just your story, it's our story too. We rejoin our road trip through the Bible in Amorite territory, where Abraham has pitched his tent under some giant oaks, known as the Great Trees of Mamre. Large trees are significant places in the ancient Near East. It is here that kings hold their courts, which is no doubt why Abraham pitches his tents here. Mamre is possibly the name of a Canaanite chieftain who allows Abraham to live on his land. Sensing that the men who have arrived at his home might be some kind of divine messengers, Abraham bows down to them. He asks God not to pass him by if he has plans for him, and offers his visitors refreshment. When they agree to stay, Sarah bakes some bread, has a calf killed and cooked, and serves up the feast with some fresh curds. Abraham stands near the visitors while they enjoy the meal. One of them asks him where Sarah is, dropping the news that when they return here in a year, she will be pregnant. Hearing all this from her tent, Sarah laughs. She knows her own body and is under no illusion that her childbearing years are behind her. God asks Abraham why his wife is laughing. Nothing is too hard for him, he says, and Sarah will have a son. Sarah is mortified that she's made a faux pas with God and lies that she didn't laugh. This doesn't wash, and God's comeback that she did lets her know that nothing escapes the divine radar. The account is quite confusing, as it's unclear who the guests are and who exactly is speaking. Are they angels speaking on behalf of God? Are they God? Does God simply join in the conversation? Several times in the Bible, God appears as a man, which is confusing for people who believe in what is commonly known as the Holy Trinity. That is, God, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit, who are all seen as equally divine. This fourth incarnation, who is exclusive to the pages of the Old Testament, suggests that God is four persons, not three. At the time his visitors come calling, Abraham has no notion of the Trinity, but he and Sarah are in no doubt that God has spoken to them. After the meal, Abraham walks with his guests to see them on their way to their next stop, the city of Sodom. While they walk, God ponders out loud whether or not to share his plans for the city with Abraham. The sense is that he is off to destroy the place. His reason for taking Abraham into his confidence is that he believes Abraham will one day be a mighty power and a blessing to all nations. God is in no doubt that Abraham will direct his household to be godly so that his descendants will live just, upright lives. That way, God can honour the promise which he has made to him. And, as an ally, it makes sense for Abraham to know the big picture. According to Genesis, God explains that he has heard stories about Sodom and needs to see for himself if these are true. Abraham is appalled that God may destroy an entire city when there must be at least some good people living there. He's no doubt thinking of his beloved nephew Lot, who still lives in Sodom, making the need for God to change his mind even more urgent. God senses Abraham's distress and agrees to spare the city if he can find him 50 good men. Given the vibe of depravity in both Sodom and Gomorrah, this number seems a little optimistic, and they soon agree on a more conservative figure of 45. This too starts to look wildly unrealistic, and in an early example of comedy in the Bible, the number reduces to 40, then 30, then 20, and finally 10. 10 seems manageable to Abraham, and he parts company with his heavenly guests and heads home. Immortalized as the ultimate den of iniquity, the angels prepare to visit Sodom and see if there are 10 good people who can spare it from divine destruction. Two of the angels who visited Abraham arrive in the city and are met by Lot, who is sitting at the gates. City gates are where local leaders meet to govern their territory, and the suggestion is that Lot is one of these rulers. It's not clear why only two angels show up rather than the three who visited the giant tree and spoke to Abraham. Some believe that the third angel is God, but this still leaves a question mark as to why he doesn't carry on with the others to Sodom, and many Bible hacks have fallen over themselves trying to explain why. Interpreting tricky Bible passages is a favourite pastime for theologians, but often the simplest, if least satisfying, answer is that no one really knows. Lot welcomes the visitors into his home and offers to put them up for the night, but the men are happy remaining out in the open in Sodom's public square. Concerned about what might happen to them here, Lot insists. The guests are brought to his house, where they enjoy a pleasant meal. However, the evening is interrupted when the men of the town arrive en masse and demand to have a sexy time with Lot's visitors. Clearly embarrassed, Lot steps out and shuts the door behind him. In a gesture that might make modern readers blanch, he offers the mob his virgin daughters instead. The men are his guests, he says, and their safety is his responsibility. It's uncertain what to make of Lot's priorities here. He would sooner give away his daughters to a violent mob than risk harming his guests. The suggestion is that he knows the men represent God, and that there is far more at stake than his or his daughter's honour. Unimpressed with the offer of ladies, the men at his door persist. They want man meat, and who is Lot to stop them anyway? Xenophobia now raises its head. Lot isn't even from Sodom. He's an incomer, and they threaten to treat him even worse than his house guests. The mob then surges forwards in an attempt to batter their way into the house. Just in the nick of time, his visitors grab Lot, pull him back inside, and slam the door after him. They then use their angelic powers to strike Sodom's men blind so they can no longer find a way into the building. Lot's guests then share their plans with him. They have come to destroy the city as a punishment for all the depraved things its people have been getting up to. They urge him to gather together any family, friends, or other dependents and get them safely away from Sodom. None of these people take Lot seriously when he passes on the message of impending doom. But when dawn breaks, the angels urge him to at least get himself, his wife, and his daughters away from danger. Lot dithers, and in the end, the angels physically grab him and his family and lead them safely out of Sodom. The angels' advice is not to look back and not to stop until they reach higher ground. Doubting his ability to scale the mountain slopes, Lot begs to be allowed to hide out in a small, insignificant town that is within running distance. The angels promise not to harm the town, and disaster is put on hold until daybreak, by which time Lot has reached safe cover. In a sequence worthy of an action movie, burning sulfur rains down from the sky and destroys Sodom, Gomorrah, and everything living in the two cities. According to the book of Deuteronomy, two nearby cities, Adma and Zeboim, are also destroyed. But, unable to overcome her curiosity, Lot's wife turns around to watch the pyrotechnics and becomes immortalized in what the Bible describes as a pillar of salt. Non-religious readers might be forgiven for having another "wait, what?" moment at this point in the story. Why a pillar of salt? As usual, there is no clear consensus, but the shores of the Dead Sea where the cities were situated are very salty. In fact, a huge salt edifice 5 miles long, 3 miles wide, and 600 feet high can be found at the southwestern extremity of the lake. It is called Jebel Uzdum, meaning Mountain of Sodom, and it is said to resemble a human figure. So, while some don't question God turning a woman into a salt pillar, others suggest that this is a modern-day Just So story to explain how Jebel Uzdum came into being. The following day, Abraham returns to the spot where he last spoke to God and sees dense smoke rising from the region of Sodom. Genesis describes the smoke as if it were coming from a furnace. The book notes that God honoured Abraham's request to spare his nephew Lot from the catastrophe that has decimated his city. While much of the early part of the Old Testament is seen by many Christians as allegory, there is sometimes evidence to suggest there might be some truth in it. Just as geologists believe that glacial meltwaters breaching the Bosphorus might have caused a cataclysmic Near Eastern flood, scientists believe there is evidence that partly backs up the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Dr. Philip Sylvia of Albuquerque's Trinity Southwest University has found archaeological evidence of extreme collapse-inducing heat and wind in the region of the two cities. This has been dated to an event 3,700 years ago, around the time Bible experts believed that Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed. Sylvia discovered zircon crystals formed within 1 second at extremely high temperatures, perhaps as hot as the surface of the sun. It's easy to see how these two cataclysmic events might have been embedded in folk memory. Were the stories in Genesis woven around these two catastrophes in order to make sense of them, or did they actually happen? Christians remain divided. Lot may not have fancied his chances at making it to the mountains in time to escape the firestorm which destroyed his city, but once the dust has settled on what was once his hometown, he moves out of his hiding place. Genesis explains that he feels unsafe in the town of Zoar. Zoar, in the local language, means small. Perhaps he feels that if the original command was to head for the mountains, he and his daughters won't be truly safe until they get away from the plane. Lot takes his two girls and flees to a mountain cave, which becomes their new home. The women realise that there is no male heir to continue their family line, and that their chances of meeting a husband in this remote place are slim. It is then that they hatch a plan to preserve their family line. Their idea is to get their father so drunk that he won't realise that he is having sex with them. One night, they ply the old man with drink, and the older daughter sleeps with him. In his drunken stupor, Lot is oblivious to what is happening. The operation is such a success that the women decide to repeat it the next night. Not one to worry about hangovers or to let last night's excess get in the way of tonight's party, Lot again drinks himself into oblivion. This time, it is the younger daughter who sleeps with her unconscious father. Clearly still a virile man, even when six sheets to the wind, Lot has unwittingly impregnated both women. The older girl gives birth to a son who she calls Moab, and the younger gives birth to Ben-Ammi. Despite their sordid beginnings, both boys grow up to be leaders of powerful tribes. Moab is the founder of the Moabites, while Ben-Ammi is the father of the Ammonites. Perhaps because of the underhand way in which they're conceived, neither sons appear to receive God's blessing, and both nations become a thorn in the side for Israel. Depravity and godlessness still appear to be the order of the day, and Abraham's nephew has barely escaped with his life. Meanwhile, Abraham and Sarah are older than ever, and still only have the son born to them by Sarah's maid Hagar. Ever nomadic, Abraham moves his family south to the Negev, to a region called Gerar. But rather than become father to the child on whose shoulders the hope of humanity rests, Abraham risks losing his wife Sarah forever. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and additional production by Johnny Hawkins. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. Please send any comments or feedback to contact@holybible.com.